customs in terms of the customs bills. In terms of customs bills, to make trade more easier, but also to do the monitoring referring to the trade that is being done. The set before the standing from the finance and assembly now referred to us. We've got our officials from the National Treasury and from SARS. I think it's Mr. Lowe. Mr. Lowe, you and your team, must please introduce them to us and take us immediately through the briefing document. There were extensive inputs from the public when this dealt before the National Assembly, the Standing Committee on Finance, so that there were public participation in that sense. Mr. Lowe, over to you, sir.
Good morning, Chair, and thank you for the opportunity to brief your committee on these bills. With me I've got Marina van Twist on my left side here, Rajesh Mohandral on the right here, and Anes on the far side here. Thank you. May I continue, Chair? Chair, on the second slide, there's just a brief index. We will start with a quick sort of a brief background as far as these bills are concerned and take you through the consultation process and then discuss a little bit the three bills and then also touch on some of the highlights or some of the issues that came up during the hearings in the Standing Committee on Finance. So that's more or less what the presentation will be all about. On slide three, Chair, just in a nutshell, you know, what is customs all about? It's difficult to explain it very briefly, but we will try. In the main, in customs is all about the administration and the control of goods that are being imported into South Africa or that's being exported out of South Africa. And the procedures to govern the imports and the exports, that's very important both for customs but also for traders out there, that they want certainty and predictability as far as these procedures are concerned. So that's the one part, the administration there. And of course then there's the collection of the duties part of the bills as well. And at the heart of that really sits the tariff determination and the value of goods and the origin of goods, because those are three very important components to make ultimately an assessment or to determine what is the amount of duty that is payable. Then, as part of all of this, there's always the challenge of trying to find a balance between facilitating trade on the one hand and making sure that there's proper control over the goods that move through South Africa. So on the one hand, we try to make things simple by way of various programs, such as accreditation programs for compliant traders, that they will get certain benefits, through risk profiling, that we don't stop every container that comes in, but only a very small proportion. But for that, we need good information, as we will see later on in the presentation. But then on the other hand, it's also our duty to also protect the society and the economy and the fiscus as far as the goods and persons that are coming through our borders. Our job is not so much the control of persons, but because persons carry goods, then persons are also important as far as the administration of these bills are concerned. So that's more or less in a nutshell what the bills are all about. Background is, I mean, why this rewrite program. The current customs bill is now 50 years old. It was written in 1964, and these bills have not kept pace with the global trade trends and technology advances. advances that have been made over the last 50 years. And it's important in today's life that we have a legislative framework from a customs point of view that reflects the modern standards and international standards. And then also, as I said, procedures, this word procedures will come up time and time again because it's, as I said, extremely important for both us and for traders to get certainty as far as their goods are concerned. There's a distinct difference between customs and excise. The current Customs and Excise Act deals with both customs and excise. The bill before you only deals with the customs part. We've only rewritten the customs part of the current bill. So what you will find before you today, Chair, is the customs duty bill. That's the money bill part of the package of trilogy of bills that are before you. That's the one that concerns the imposition of the duties. The second one is the customs control bill. That's the one that contains all the procedures to govern the movement of the goods. And then the last one is then the amendment bill to the current one, to the current Customs and Excise Act, in terms of which we've stripped out now and repealed all the old and customs provisions in the Customs and Excise Bill. So what is left in the, what will be left ultimately in the Customs and Excise Act will only be the excise part of it. And therefore the Act is also renamed now, the old Act, the 64 Act, as the Excise Act. And the intention is that we will start the rewrite of the excise part later this year, and hopefully maybe we can bring it to Parliament next year or the year after that. Some of the benefits as far as the rewrite process is concerned, the bill supports also the National Development Plan. We will touch on these issues in more detail later on, where we show how it promotes exports, business competitiveness, it stimulates manufacturing, and it supports SMMEs. It then also provides for the clear and predictable policies and procedures, as we've said. We've tried our best to align it with the Constitution and with international agreements which South Africa is a signatory to. It supports regional integration. An example of that is the one-stop border posts. In a modern customs environment, it's also necessary that we reduce unnecessary red tape and corruption and prevent delays at the borders, etc. So the bill gives us a much better grip over the whole sort of customs value chain and allows us much better control over the movements of goods. And then, as we've said, and notwithstanding the emphasis on trade facilitation to assist the economy, there's always the importance of the control part. And to find that balance can sometimes be a very tricky thing to do. The bill also supports other national legislation like ITAC, agriculture and health. We work very closely with ITAC and DTI because trade policy is set by the DTI. We try to write the law in more simple language and to simplify it so that you can navigate and find your way to a specific provision much easier. It now also deals more comprehensively with valuation provisions to combat fraud and so on. So there's hopefully lots of benefits that will flow from this process. We've also looked at the commitment to international agreements. The bills now comply 100% with all the general annexes to the WCO revised Kyoto Convention. That is the sort of the blueprint for a modern customs legislative framework. There are two sets of annexes, the general ones, and we comply with all the standards there. The specific annexes, we comply with most of them. South Africa is not a party to any of the specific annexes. There's very few countries who are parties to all these specific annexes. They are there as guidelines. The bill also complies with the SAFE framework of standards, That's a standard that came in, as you will remember, after the 9/11 event in the U.S., where we now, the world tried to rely much more on advanced electronic information than the use of non-intrusive detection equipment such as scanners and so on. And for businesses that meet the supply chain, for the compliant ones, that you provide certain benefits to them. We also check the GATT rules, the GATT provisions or the GATT agreement deals with the valuation or the principles around the valuation of goods. We align with the International Convention on the Harmonized Commodity Description and Coding System, that's the tariff, the harmonized system, the tariff system. We looked at SACU, there's the Istanbul Convention that we've got to comply with, that deals with the temporary admission of goods. Then we also did some international benchmarking. In addition to the Kyoto Convention, we've looked at various other countries. We've looked extensively at the Australian legislation, the Canadian one specifically, because of the constitutional similarities between South Africa and Canada, New Zealand, and then for specific topics we looked at India, the EU, the UK, and there's various others that we've also looked at. There was a customs green paper that set out the sort of customs policy that we published some years ago that also gave us some guidance as far as the policies that we used. Consultation, Chair, we tried to slice it up. First, we will deal with the consultation that we had with SACU and the other organs of state. You will see this process started many, many years ago where we sort of signaled to our SACU members in 2003 already that we want to embark on this process. And we circulated the green paper, the policy paper, and the first customs bill in 2007 already, so that's almost 7 years ago, 6 years ago already. That bill was a single bill. The control part and the duty part was in one bill, and we briefed various government departments and on this. We had sessions with our Treasury colleagues and ITAC and DTI as far as the policy direction is concerned, and many other government stakeholders as well, like agriculture, home affairs, DIRCO, SAPS, etc. Then we, from that process, we saw it would be better if we split the bills into two, a duty part and a control part. We will explain that later, that the customs control bill will serve as a platform for the customs duty, but also later on, when the excise part is rewritten, it also serves as a platform for VAT, the import VAT that we collect. So the control bill serves as a platform for many other taxes, not just the customs duties that we collect. SACU, we had quite a number of interactions with during the period 2009 to 2013. We briefed the various government clusters, the economic clusters, the trade clusters, and the JCBS clusters. And we took the bill to Cabinet, and Cabinet approved the bills in June last year. Then there was consultation with the public prior to the parliamentary process. The draft bills were released to the public for comment in 2009. Once again, we had various interactions, and we received comments from various entities and institutions and representative bodies. We also took this bill through NEDLAG. We spent almost 3 years in NEDLAG on these bills from 2009 to 2012. Then after that, the bills were again, or during that period in 2011, while the bills were before NEDLAG, we again released a version. Comments were again received, and then the final cabinet-approved version was again circulated and put on our website in August 2013. That was just before the parliamentary process started. Then on the next slide, even during the parliamentary process, we've had many, many interactions as well with the various parties who are involved in the customs process, the shipping lines. We've had many interactions with them, some government institutions as well. SAFU once again. SAFU is the South African Association of Freight Forwarders. They are really the agents who act on behalf of importers and exporters. So they are really the people who do all the work, provide all the customs clearances for goods to be imported, etc. The Gauteng province we've had interactions with, we will see later on, because one of the issues you might have noticed in the press that was debated quite extensively was the whole issue around inland terminals, and specifically the one, the City Deep one, which is in Gauteng. So we've had interactions with the Gauteng province on that one as well. We've had discussions with BUSA and also the Johannesburg Chamber of Industry as well, and Transnet, etc. Chair, then, as we said, the bills we can see in sort of two different contexts. The one is how it then improves trade facilitation and underpins the National Development Plan on the one side, and then on the other side how it improves the control over goods. So first of all, there's a few areas on the trade facilitation part that I just want to touch on. The first one is the transparency and the predictability of doing business in South Africa, how the bill improves that. As I said then earlier on, there are now very clear procedures for all different types of customs procedures that you can have. The bill clearly spells out, and you'll see later on in the different chapters. There's a chapter, there's a procedure for everything described in detail in the bill that makes it much more predictable for business to do business in South Africa. We also propose an advanced ruling regime, so if people want to have upfront certainty about a ruling on a specific product, they can approach us. We also make provision that we can issue interpretation notes and guidelines to explain the law better. We have a different penalty regime that makes things also more predictable and gives greater consistency as far as the application of it. Previously it was very discretionary. Now there's much more uniformity, as, or hopefully there will be much more uniformity as far as the imposition of penalties are concerned. We propose that the tax court be used to resolve some of the customs disputes. We have a tax court that for many, many decades already operate in the tax environment, and we would like to use the that court facility also for customs purposes. The tax ombud will also be able to adjudicate on some administrative and procedural issues from a customs perspective to help to resolve disputes and complaints. Then the bills also promote exports. There's some examples here where in certain instances where it's impossible, where a trader doesn't have all the information to provide customs with an incomplete export declaration document, where for example the container number is not available at the time, and then later on they can file a supplementary declaration. There are also provision made for simplified clearances for various categories of goods, for example perishable goods that need to move very fast and on an expedited basis. Then doing business is also hopefully more streamlined in terms of the proposed bills. Compliant traders will now be placed in a much more equitable position, that they will get interest on when refunds that have not been paid to them in time, within 21 days. This is a rule that we aligned with our VAT legislation. We are doing away in certain instances with multiple clearances. Currently, if goods are being imported, and it needs to be warehoused, say inland, then you need to file a transit declaration and then a warehouse declaration. We've combined those into one single declaration, for example. Multiple cargo reports will also not be necessary anymore. We will see later on when we get to the provisions that deal with reporting. We now are going to focus much more on advanced reporting. So if goods, say, come from China, for example, 24 hours before the goods are being loaded on a ship in China on the harbor, they need to report to South Africa what goods will be loaded on the ship, so that we already at that stage can start there to control the value chain. So we can, for example, then from the description of the goods already see at that stage whether there's perhaps prohibited goods in a container or restricted goods, and then we can inform the parties at that stage already you can't load these goods on the ship. So therefore, we don't need all these multiple reporting stages in between anymore. We start much more earlier in the process, and unless there's a change in information, you don't need to report when the goods arrive at the port anymore. There's also now provision for the extension of time frames and various other areas as well where we can improve the environment for businesses, small businesses. There's later on a slide that specifically only deals with small businesses, how we try to improve the environment for small business so that they can flourish in doing business in South Africa. So I'll leave that for later on. We'll come back to that. So that's just a little bit on the facilitation side and to make things easier. But as I said, there's the other side, there's the control side. So the Customs Control Bill regulates the control of goods. As I said, the process actually starts already in the export country. And then when the goods arrive in South Africa, we control the movement of it from the time that it enters the Republic until it either leaves the Republic again or until it ultimately goes into home use and it goes outside customs control. So we have a much more improved supply chain. Apart from the offshore part, when you start at the South African borders, there's first of all there's the registration and licensing, which is the first sort of point in the supply chain that governs the control of goods. Certain people like importers and exporters, they need to be registered. Certain places need to be licensed. There's a reporting, as I said, even before loading in the export country. If goods move from a first port of entry to an inland area and containers need to be sealed, there's a much improved sealing provisions in place now. Goods under export procedure must also be transported by licensed carriers. That's to prevent the round tripping and the diversion of goods. So there's hopefully much better control over the supply chain. So then we start with the bills itself. And if we can start with the first one, which is the Customs Duty Bill, as I said, which is the money bill part. Now the Customs Duty Bill is the one that imposes the duties and provides for the assessment of duties and the payment of duties. Now, as I've said, the Customs Duty Bill and many other tax levying acts will ultimately rely on the platform which is provided by the Customs Control Bill. Now, the Customs Duty Bill gives maximum effect to the concept of self-assessment. So traders, when they import, they make their own tariff classification, they put their own value on the goods, and they determine what is the origin of goods. As mentioned earlier on, these three points are really the sort of building blocks as far as a customs duty point is concerned and sits at the heart of the duty process. Tariff is important, obviously. You need to put it in the correct tariff classification to determine what is the percentage of duty that needs to be placed on it. The value is important because the percentage needs to be applied to the value. And the origin is important because we have international agreements in terms of which we have preferential rates. For example, with the EU, we have certain preferential rates that works on a reciprocal basis. So it's important to know whether the goods comes from the EU or whether it comes from SADC or whether it comes from China, because there are different rates that apply to different areas in the world. Then customs focuses to a large extent on the verification whether the trader has applied himself or herself correct as far as the self-assessment process is concerned. So then quickly, as far as the different chapters in the duty bill is concerned, chapter one normally, as in any bill, deals with all the definitions and the application of the act, and it assigns the administration of the act. Chapter 2 then sets the customs tariff, which will be the schedules ultimately attached to the customs act, that sets the different duties that needs to be imposed. It also makes provision for amendments to the customs tariff, and it also makes provision for provisional payments of anti-dumping duties and countervailing duties and safeguard duties. Chapter 3 then deals with the payment of the duties, and here there are once again different parties. It states when the liability arises for on goods, and liability normally arises when the goods enters the Republic. It then sets the time when it must be paid, and then there's also deferment periods that can be allowed before the duty becomes ultimately payable. And there's procedures that's set out in the bill that regulates these payment and the recovery of duty processes. It also provides for the liability of payment of agents, and it also stipulates the procedures for interest and penalties, and for the securing of the payment of any debt in the form of, for example, liens that can be placed over goods. So that's more or less chapter 3 that deals with the payment part. Chapter 4 deals with refunds and drawbacks. When refunds, people become entitled to refunds, and when drawbacks are allowed in respect of import duties. Chapter 5 here deals with the assessment. As we said, that the Act is self-reliant on self-assessment, but it does make provision that if customs finds that the importer made an incorrect assessment or self-assessment, that we can then issue a new assessment or a reassessment. It provides for timelines within which these reassessments can be made. Normally it's within 3 years. It also now introduces a general anti-avoidance rule. Previously, in the customs environment, we didn't have that. We have it in the tax environment, but we are now introducing that in the customs environment as well. Chair, what I forgot to mention, when I start with the chapters, the parts that are in red are sort of the new or sort of noteworthy changes. The parts that are in black are normally, you will find in the existing laws, but the red parts are sort of new or improved parts to the as far as the new bills are concerned. So it gives you an idea what is existing and what is sort of new or improved in the new bills. It also creates a statutory presumption that the duty assessments and reassessments are correct. This is a standard rule that you find in tax laws. Chapter 6 deals with the classification of goods. So as we said, when goods come in, the trader must, and normally it's the customs brokers who act on behalf of the importers, they must make a self-determination of the tariff, Then it provides for reassessments, once again within timelines, and the same presumption rules. That you will find in chapter 6, as far as the tariff is concerned. Chapter 7, the valuation, exactly the same principles apply there. Self-determination, redeterminations, etc. Origin, exactly the same rules. Self-determination, redetermination, time limits. So you'll find that is a sort of a golden thread that runs through chapters 5, 6, 7, and 8. Chapter 9, Chair, that deals with preferential tariff treatment. I mentioned earlier on that South Africa is a signatory to quite a number of reciprocal international trade agreements in relation to goods imported into or exported from South Africa. The EU and SADC, I think, are probably the two biggest ones. So the bills cater for that, that we give effect to the these international agreements that we are signatories to. Then there are non-reciprocal types of generalized preferences on a country-by-country basis, where there are also certain preferences given. For example, we've got a range, and we've just mentioned two there with Turkey and Russia, and they offer preferential in rates, for example, that goods that are being exported from South Africa to those countries, and they give us preferential rates when the goods are imported into those countries. Advanced rulings is new, that we make provision for that in the customs environment now as well in Chapter 10. Chapter 11, we have a new penalty regime that we propose in terms of the bill. It will be a sort of a three-tiered system. There will be fixed amount penalties for non-prosecutable breaches. For example, is a person submitting a refund claim without a supporting document, then you can get a fixed amount penalty for that. Then there are fixed percentages of the penalties, which is a more stricter type of penalty, where a person, for example, fails to pay the duties in time, there is a fixed 10% penalty in respect of the late payment. And then there are the more severe type of penalties, prosecution avoidance penalties. If a person is not being prosecuted, it is possible that the person can pay a penalty to avoid prosecution. It is impossible to process all offences through the criminal court, so, and it's a standard thing that you make provision that in certain instances people can pay penalties to avoid prosecution. In chapter 12, we prescribe the different kinds of offences. There are category 1 and category 2 types of offences. Category 1 are the more serious types of offences, and the penalties that will go with that. For example, when people make false statements or there's fraud involved, and then the category 2 ones where there are less serious offences. These are all administrative penalties that are then imposed in terms of the customs bill, different types of administrative penalties. And then lastly, Chair, the customs duty bill also makes provision for various types of miscellaneous matters, of which the biggest one is probably the empowering provisions to make subsidiary legislation, and in the customs environment that's normally done in the form of rules. So the enabling provisions prescribe what sort of consultative process must be followed when you make these rules, the manner in which it must be promulgated, etc. And then it also has a sort of a general rule that allows the commissioner in under certain circumstances to approve the departure from some rules that's being made in terms of the law, or the condemnation of non-compliance with rules in extraordinary type of circumstances. Chair, then we get to the customs control bill. As I said, that this is really now the one that will serve as the platform for many other duty bills, such as the customs duty bill, but also the VAT one, and in future also the excise bills that needs to be rewritten. This one is the thicker one. You will see there are the three bills before you, but this one is the thicker one. And which is then concerned with the control of goods throughout the whole customs value chain. So you can see, if we start with number one on the left hand side there, where the commissioner can demarcate in certain places of entry and exit into or from South Africa, from where the control of the imports and exports of the goods will then of course start. We've talked about the advanced reporting that already starts, you know, in the country of export. So by the time that goods or people arrive in South Africa, we already know about them. Then there's the whole registration and licensing part around customs, where importers and exporters need to register, and certain premises and in some instance persons also need to be licensed. Then once the goods come in and it moves beyond the first ports of entry, then it can go either into or out of terminals. And as the goods move along the value chain, the bill prescribes in each instance what is the tax status of the goods. For example, when goods come into the country and it moves from the, say, the first port of entry to an inland terminal, then the goods move in transit. And then while it moves in transit, it has a tax-free status. It's only when goods go into home consumption, then it has a big, or sort of, it reaches a tax due status. Because customs duty, Chair, is a consumption tax. It's a destination-based consumption tax. So it's similar to that. So it's only when goods go into home use or when goods are consumed that the customs duty actually becomes payable. It's the same with VAT. VAT can also move through the different chains, but it's only the final consumer that actually pays the VAT. So we regulate the tax status of goods as far as the customs status thereof is also concerned. Another example, if goods are export, because then it's a destination-based consumption goods, because if goods are exported, they are not consumed in South Africa, therefore if they exported, they are exempt from customs duty. Similar also in the VAT scenario, because if goods are consumed outside the borders of South Africa. Then there are the different kinds of procedures, as I've said and I've spoken about earlier on. There are extensive provisions that regulate the different kinds of procedures. There are warehousing procedures, there are transit procedures, there are transshipment procedures. We'll get to them later on. So for every stage that goods sort of moves, there is a procedure that is being prescribed for it. Then, as I said, when goods ultimately goes into free circulation for home use, then we can start to collect the duty, and then that is prescribed, the collection procedures. There are enforcement procedures, we'll get to that later on, because although the bills work on a self-assessment basis, there are also the non-compliant traders, and we need a certain level of enforcement procedures to ultimately make sure that we get the correct amount of duty from those people as well. And then ultimately number 10, if there is a dispute, then there are dispute resolution mechanisms that also kick in. So that's more or less the value chain when as the goods move through South Africa or ultimately for home use in South Africa. Chair, then I will quickly and then just run through the different kinds of chapters. Time unfortunately is not on our side. There are 41 chapters. We will sit here for days if we've got to go extensively into each one.
So we've got time until 1 o'clock.
Chapter 1 deals with the administration and the application. Chapter 2 then deals with the entry and exit of places that the commissioner appoints. Chapter 2 regulates the reporting requirements, as we said, that starts already in outside the borders, but that continues inside the borders as well. 4 deals with the general principles of clearance and the release of goods. 5 with the general principles of transport when goods move in transit in South Africa or through South Africa, and the sealing of containers to make sure that goods are not diverted into the Republic. 6 deals with the status, as I explained. 7 with the older standard and processes around and clearance. Number 8 deals with home use, as I've said that it's only when goods go into home use in South Africa when the duty becomes payable. 9 deals with in-transit. Goods can move in-transit within the border, say from a port to an inland terminal, or in-transit through South Africa, perhaps up when it leaves our borders into Africa again. 11 deals with transshipment when goods perhaps come with a vessel, say from India, but the vessel only goes up to South Africa. But it's somebody in the UK who wants to import the goods, so then it is transshipped or offloaded here, and it's transshipped onto another vessel, and then from here another ship then takes it to the UK, for example. So it's transshipped. It's the same goods transshipped from one vessel to another in South Africa, at a South African harbour. Temporary admission, goods sometimes comes in on a temporary basis. Say sports persons come into South Africa and they bring equipment in that they take out. Once again, you don't want duty on that. Warehousing, sometimes when goods are imported, all of the goods can't go into home consumption immediately, so it's warehoused sometimes for a period. Your stock, say it's a trader, he imports, but he doesn't have all his goods in his shop at the same time, so he warehouses some of it. So as he needs the stock, it comes out of the warehouse and it moves into his shop, where it then is being sold into the market for home use. Tax-free shops, you've all seen them at the airports when you leave South Africa. There are tax-free shops where you can buy goods then free of custom duty and that. Stores that deals with the stores that goes onto foreign going ships or aircraft that is being used there or that is meets the needs of the voyage, for example, provisions that are needed for travelers that are on the ships or on the aircraft or for the operations of the vessel or the ship. But these are also international vessels and international ships or trains that are crossing our borders. Temporary exports. Then there's inward processing. What happens with inward processing is goods that are being imported, it goes into, say for example, a manufacturing process in South Africa, and then it is exported again. So it comes into South Africa, it comes inward for processing, and then it goes out again. Because it's not consumed in South Africa, we don't want duty on it, but we need to control it while it is in South Africa. Home use processing is where goods are being imported. Once in grain, it goes into either some sort of a process for either manufacturing or repairing or whatever the case might be in South Africa, but then it goes ultimately for home use in South Africa. And then outward processing is where goods originates in South Africa. It goes out. We perhaps don't have the capability to do a portion of the manufacturing in South Africa. It goes out to another country where a further manufacturing process is being added to it, and then it comes back to South Africa. And then there's only duty payable on the value-added part. The part that originally came from South Africa is then not subject to duty. Processing of persons, we've got to deal with persons, although the bills are mainly about goods, but as we said, persons also carry goods, that we've got to deal with the control of persons as well. International post articles, many people order goods via post, that it comes in parcels or envelopes to the post offices, so that also needs to be regulated. The sampling of goods needs to be regulated, expedited clearance and releases of goods. There's damaged and destroyed goods or lost goods. We need to know how to deal with them. If goods are being imported but they're destroyed or lost, they won't go into home consumption, so you should not really have a duty on it, but you need to control it and make sure that the goods are actually lost or destroyed. The same with abandoned goods. State warehouses, those are goods that are being detained and confiscated that ultimately goes into warehouses. Registration and licensing, it's a very important part of the control. As we said, that we read all importers and exporters needs to be registered, and certain premises, customs control areas, as you know, at an airport where your customs officers function, or at a harbor, or at a land border post, or other places inside those areas needs to be licensed. Accreditation, we will deal with that later on, but that's a system in terms of which certain benefits are being afforded to compliant traders. The security for payment, sometimes people can't pay the full duty at once and we ask for security for it, or it's not necessary to pay the full amount, but we just want security while the goods are in South Africa. The recovery of debt, the general enforcement provisions, we'll get to it later on. The procedures to detain goods and to seize it. And then 35 deals with prohibited, restricted goods. So prohibited goods are, for example, drugs that are coming into South Africa. They are prohibited, so the customs officers need to confiscate it. Restricted goods, for example, are goods that are coming in under a permit that's issued under the DTI. We need to control it and monitor it. Counterfeit goods, there we work closely with the DTI to make sure that counterfeit goods are not coming into South Africa, and there are specific processes for our officers how to deal with counterfeit goods. Then there's dispute resolution that we've mentioned. Voluntary disclosure, if somebody has committed an offense and they want to regularize their position, they may approach SARS to voluntarily disclose the offense and then pay the duties, and there's certain relief in the form of penalties that we can then provide. 39 again deals with penalties in terms of the Customs Control Act. We've, both these acts have got penalties. The one, the duty bill has got penalties, but the Control Act also has penalties. And then there's the judicial matters and certain miscellaneous issues. So those are, in a nutshell, Chair, all the 41 chapters in the Customs Control Bill. I just want to highlight a few of these chapters, Chairman. The one on Chapter 2, for example, is important from a control point of view. It identifies then all the goods or persons that are subject to customs control, and then it provides for the designation of certain places where these goods and persons can either then enter or exit South Africa, and where they will then be processed. Now, these places are being identified or designated by the commissioner, and they are called customs control areas. And then the bill also provides for certain exclusions or exemptions in relation to some of these places of entry and exit. It's a very important area, because that is when goods enter South Africa or persons enter South Africa, they all go through these places of entry and exit. And it's at these places that we work very closely with many of our sister departments, such as Home Affairs, the police, etc., to regulate the persons and goods that are moving into and out of South Africa. Reporting, as I have said, is a very important part in a modernized customs system. That's why when the old Act was written in 1964, we all lived in a paper environment. Nowadays things are electronic, it's much easier to start at a much earlier process to start identifying who ultimately will cross your borders and what goods will ultimately cross your borders. Therefore, we need to know about these arrivals or future arrivals at a much earlier stage. So therefore, as I said earlier on, at least 24 hours now in terms of the safe framework, a ship needs to give notice of the goods that will be loaded onto a ship in a foreign jurisdiction so that we can prevent the loading of prohibited and restricted goods on the ship. And once we've got that information, and if there's no change to it subsequently, we don't need any further advances. Only it's when the goods ultimately are then cleared for some or other process that we need then further interaction. Then there are certain general principles as far as the clearance of goods are concerned. The old rules provide that goods must be cleared within 7 days. We've reduced the period now to 3 days. In an electronic environment today, it's much easier now to do things much faster. In any case, when we see later on when we get to containerized goods, most goods that almost 60% or 70% of goods that come to South Africa are containerized goods, and in those instances we actually need a clearance 3 days in advance, 3 days before the ship arrives in South Africa. We will get clearance now in terms of the new rules. So these chapter 4 just sets out the sort of general principles as far as clearance of goods are concerned. Chapter 9 deals with the movement in transit. This is the inland terminals issue. When containerized goods arrive ultimately at an inland port, but the goods need to be cleared, also need to be moved to an inland terminal, for example, City Deep near Johannesburg. Currently, the goods can move on a manifest from the first port of entry to the inland terminal, and we, as we will see later on, we are proposing certain changes that we now require a proper customs clearance in this regard, because the manifest does not have sufficient information on it. We will deal with it later on. I don't want to repeat it all now, so that we can have much better risk assessment in respect of those goods. Chapter 10 deals with imported goods that are ultimately transported into an excise warehouse. Although we haven't rewritten the excise part of it, but there is one chapter in the customs control bill that deals with goods that moves from a customs duty environment into a custom, sort of an excise manufacturing warehouse, so we had to regulate that. Chapter 11 deals with the with transshipment. I've mentioned that in quickly in earlier on. That's where goods are being transferred from at the same seaport or at the same airport from one vessel to another or from one aircraft to another, and we need to control that, and that can be done in terms of a manifest if the manifest provides the required information. This is an extremely important development for South Africa for an economic or from an employment creation provision for this in transshipment. You find this in many, many big areas. For example, Singapore is a huge transshipment hub as well. Chapter 13 provides for public and private warehouses. Here we need to distinguish between sort of state warehouses where customs goods that are being confiscated by the customs authorities that's being put into a state warehouse on the one hand. What we're talking about here are public and private warehouses where goods can be stored, as I mentioned earlier. Not everything can go into home consumption immediately, so many of the goods are being housed in a public or a private warehouse temporarily until it then either goes into home consumption or it goes, ultimately it's been exported again, etc. Now, a very important development here is that we will in future now allow the storage of goods that are free of duty, but that are subject to VAT, and goods that are in free circulation in the same warehouse. Previously, we did not allow that, but this is an important development not just from a South African perspective, but also many of our traders that are now operating into Africa, that have, many, for example, retailers, they've got huge warehouses in South Africa, which they store goods for ultimately to feed into the South African market or into the African market. And it's much more economic for them to store both goods that are free of duty and goods that are already in free circulation into the same warehouse. Previously, they had to store it into two separate warehouses. But now we will allow it subject to strict control, because you can understand we can't mix the two, because on the one hand the duty has been paid, and on the other hand it has not been paid. So you can't start mixing it. So in the old days, to control it better, they said, no, you've got to keep it into two separate warehouses, then it's easier to control. We live in a modern day world today, so we will allow it now in the same warehouse, but subject to very strict controls and procedures. Here then, chapter 16 deals with the export procedures, and there's a control part to it, but there's also a facilitation part to it. From the control part, then exports, it's important that we control it, because as I said, goods that are being exported, there's no duty in South Africa or VAT in South Africa. But around exports, there are lots of games that are being played around exports, sort of ghost exports that are supposedly going out of South Africa, and then it sort of is diverted back into South Africa without the payment of any goods. And we find that especially around cigarettes, but many other types of goods as well. So we have beefed up provisions as far as export procedures are concerned. There are certain time frames for the submission of export clearances now, before the good reaches a terminal. The granting of the release for export clearances when the goods reach a customs control area are much more tighter regulated now. There are better procedures now in place for our customs officer how to deal with these goods that are not properly exported, etc. So it's very important that we have a tight grip over the export of goods so that we can reduce the loss of both VAT and customs duties as far as that is concerned. But on the other hand, we also need to facilitate exports as well. And that's why there are a number of initiatives that we propose in the bill to make it much easier. As I said, in certain instances where all the information is not known at the time the export process must start, you can file an incomplete declaration and the export process can kick off, but you can at a later stage file supplementary declarations before the goods then ultimately reach the terminal and before it leaves South Africa. Chapter 18 and 19 deals with inward processing and home use. I think I've touched on the inward processing part where it comes in and it's then manufactured. And then it goes out. But an important feature here is that goods can also now, in such an inward processing process, be replaced by equivalent goods. It doesn't have to be exactly the same goods. For example, say you are baking cakes in South Africa that you want to export, and you need sugar, and you've imported sugar. You don't actually need to use the imported sugar, you can use local sugar as well, as long as it's goods of an equivalent nature and of the same quantities that goes into the process. Home use, I think we've explained that. That's where there's also a process when it comes in and there's a rebate of duty on the imports, but in such an instance the goods are not exported, it actually goes into free circulation in South Africa, and we have our own unique sort of home use industrial program here in the form of the APDP. It's what is called previously the MIDP, that's the program for the automotive industry in South Africa. I think I've touched on the next slide already, Chair, where we provide for the fast tracking of home use and for exports, where we can allow in incomplete and provisional clearances, and then later on for a supplementary clearance to be filed. I think we've touched on this one. Registration, Chair, is registration, this one, and licensing in chapters 28 and 29, as I said, are two very important processes in the control of the customs process. Any person who imports or exports goods must be registered in South Africa, whether you are located in South Africa or not. If you are not, if you're a foreign person, but you import and export from South Africa, then you must appoint a representative in South Africa, which must have a location then in South Africa, because it's important there must always be somebody in South Africa that we can hold responsible. I think the other point that I just want to highlight here is the from a registration point of view, that there will in future, or that we propose in terms of the new bills, that there will be an automatic expiry of your registration if your entity in terms of which you trade has been dormant for a period of 3 years and there's no activity that we've seen that have gone through your records either as an importer or an exporter. That's from a control point of view, a safety mechanism. And also to have a clean register of importers and exporters. Licensing, Chair, I think we've touched on licensing. Licensing is where we then need to license certain control areas, be it sea terminals, or rail terminals, or postal clearance depots, or state warehouses. There are sort of specific and general conditions that will go with these licensing procedures, and all licenses will in future also just be valid for a period of 3 years, and then you need to reapply for a license. Once again, it's from a control point of view that we make sure that people are compliant and customs compliant when they operate at one of these areas that have been licensed. Accreditation. This is an international movement that have gained a lot of advance over the last number of years, where certain preferences are being conferred on an accredited client if the person is tax compliant and the person has proved over a period that the person complies with all the customs procedures, then you can get certain benefits. And the benefits are, for example, the fast tracking of clearance and the release procedures, the fast tracking procedures around the processing of documents, or you'll get a better deferment of tax on the goods that you import, or there will be a simplified payment procedure for you. So it depends on your accredited client status. And this is one of the broader mechanisms to make sure that the goods that come into South Africa are properly controlled. It's nowadays, Chair, there is more than 4 million containers of goods that are either coming in or are leaving South Africa. And it's impossible for us. We have about 2,000, just over 2,000 customs officers. It's impossible to inspect and to open each one of those containers. You will clog the ports for days and months. So Currently, we inspect about between 1 and 2% of those containers that are coming in. And the international movement is to also to try and stop as little as possible of containers. But the trick is really to pick the correct containers to stop. And for that, you need information. So information is the game, the name of the game today. You've got to have proper information to target the correct containers or parcels that are coming in through the post, and to have a good risk profiling system. And this is one of the processes. If you're a trusted trader, then we rely on you to a large extent that you won't import restricted or prohibited goods, that we will give you a preferred status as far as that is concerned. But the day that we catch you, that you are transgressing the rules, you move to the bottom of the catalogue again. So there's not one silver bullet in the whole process to control goods that will make a person compliant. It's a whole range of things that we've got to put in place. And overall, all of this is good information that you get either from the trader, that you get from third parties, private third parties, other government institutions, foreign agencies, etc., so that it all enables you to have a good risk profiling system, and only to home in on those goods that you think and that you've got a good sense that it's goods that are not complying with the customs rules. Chapter 33 deals with enforcement. So although we work on the basis that the vast majority of people are compliant traders, there are always that small element that are not playing the game, and for those ones you need certain enforcement procedures as well. And these procedures include, for example, the right to gather information, to access somebody's premises, to inspect certain samples of goods, or to investigate, in certain instances to arrest, although we mainly rely on the police to arrest people, to carry firearms. Even in those instances, it is in very rare instances that customs officers will carry firearms. We rely on police that then go with us on raids where we suspect that we need a person, an armed person in the process. The stopping and the searching of persons and goods, detaining goods, seizing goods, or confiscating goods, these are the sort of general international enforcement powers that you'll find in any jurisdiction. In chapter 39, you will find the administrative penalties in the customs control environment. Once again, there's a tiered system, there's fixed penalties, there's prosecution avoidance penalties, there's termination of seizure or the withdrawal of confiscation penalties. An example of that is, for example, where goods have been confiscated and it needs to be returned to the owner. Say, for example, it's an innocent person's vehicle that has been used to smuggle goods in, and the vehicle has now been confiscated, then it's possible that we can ultimately, subject to a certain penalty, give the vehicle back to the person. Missing good penalties, etc. Then it also depends on the volume or the number of penalties or breaches that you have within a specific period. Depending on the number, the penalties can double or triple ultimately. Small businesses, Chair, there are specific things that we're trying to do in terms of the control bill also to make it easier for small businesses. The Commissioner is generally empowered to prescribe licensing requirements that's responsible or responsive to the size or turnover of a particular business. Now, a small business can be such a criteria for from a turnover point of view, that we say certain businesses below a certain turnover, it will not be necessary for them to register under certain circumstances or to be licensed under certain circumstances where they, for example, subcontract in the processing that's needed to be done by a bigger business and it falls below certain thresholds. They will pay smaller fees for advanced rulings. We can extend certain time frames for certain categories of persons. Of small business can be such a category. So there are various areas where we can provide for certain exemptions or extensions for small businesses subject to certain criteria. Then, Chair, the last bill is the Customs and Excise Amendment Bill. That's the one that I've mentioned earlier on, that we are now stripping the customs part out, and what is left in the old Customs and Excise Bill will only be the excise part, and the bill is now also renamed then as the Excise Duty Act 1964. Chair, then the last part of the presentation, we just want to touch on a few issues that came up during the hearing. There were mainly three areas that were quite extensively debated during the hearings process in the Standing Committee. That was the issue around the inland terminals, the city deep area, penalties, and also the issues around rules, customs rules. Now, currently, when goods are imported, containerized goods, those goods can move on a manifest from the first place of entry to an inland terminal. As I said, City Deep is such an inland terminal. Now, a manifest is just a summary of all the cargo that is on board of a vessel or on an aircraft. And it just gives us a very general description of what those goods are. And it also is not a description that is being provided by the importer. It is a description that is given to the goods by the foreign party to the goods. Now, the problem with a manifest is that the manifest does not give us sufficient information to do a proper risk assessment of the goods. And to do a proper risk assessment of the goods, you know exactly what the tariff of description of the goods are. And you need that, for example, because our lists of prohibited and restricted goods work on the tariff coding that is programmed into our customs electronic systems. And unless we have a proper description of the tariff, it is impossible to make a determination as to the risk of the goods. The same as far as the value of the goods. Many, many goods are undervalued. Also, the origin of the goods. You need to know what the origin of the goods is. Now, the manifest doesn't tell you what the origin is at all. It doesn't give you a value. It just gives you a vague description of what the goods are. So the whole intention why we want to have a different policy procedure as far as this is concerned, to have better information so that we can do a better risk analysis as far as the goods are concerned, so that we can be more targeted just to inspect the correct number of or the real containers that we think are carrying risky goods. On slide 44 then, what we propose going forward is that the goods cannot move on a manifest anymore. We need a customs clearance declaration now, and this customs clearance declaration must be given to us electronically, and it will be given to us 3 days before the ship arrives at the first port of entry. And it will have full details of the tariffs and the value and the origin of the good. That's the least information that needs to be on it. And this information will now be given to us by the importer, and normally it will be the agent in South Africa that acts on behalf of the importer. So there will be somebody that we can hold responsible in South Africa now if there is a problem with the goods ultimately. The revised proposal, Chair, will then, from a process point of view, work as follows. When we get the clearance documentation 3 days in advance, we will provisionally allow the goods to be released, and the importer can start to plan its sort of value chain. And the significance of the 3 days, Chair, is that Transnet, because once good now arrived at the first port of entry and it needs to be moved inland, it can either go by rail or it can go by road. Now, for the goods to move by rail from the first port of entry to the inland terminal, Transnet needs 3 days in advance to plan the rail stacking, to get the rail carriages lined up for the containers to go onto the trains. So that's why we need 3 days, so that there can be a seamless movement. Then if you want to use rail, and we want to encourage the use of rail as well, so that 3 days in advance, Transnet can be informed, the port authorities can be informed, they can start planning the system for the movement of goods inland. There's then certainty and predictability as far as that is concerned. When the goods ultimately arrive at the first port of entry, we will give the final release, and the goods can then move. Those who want to use rail can use rail. Those who still want to use road can still use road. What we've said here, there was quite a lot of debate around this issue, that this change will clog up the ports, it will impact on the contractual relationships of the importers and the exporters, and it will now shift the movement of goods from rail to road, etc. This was hotly contended by both BUSA and the Johannesburg Chamber of Industry during the hearings process. But we've ultimately, Chair, reached an agreement with the South African Freight Forwarders Association. They are the people who act on behalf of importers. They support this move now. We've had various consultations with Transnet. Transnet is in support with it. What we will also do when the bills are ultimately promulgated, we will allow a period of 12 months before this new process will kick in, so to give everybody sufficient time to plan. And then we have, as a last resort, a fallback situation, and it's not just for this, it's for any, we had it when we introduced then the Value Added Tax Act as well. We have a general clause in the bills to provide for unforeseen circumstances, that we can somehow deviate from the provisions of the Act. So in case there is a problem then as far as these inland terminals are concerned, it is possible that we can revert back to what the situation is today. But we don't foresee that there should be a problem. We've done a lot of consultation as far as this is concerned. We've done international benchmarking. This is the international move now. As I said, information is the name of the game. You need to have that information before the goods arrive in South Africa. And why do you want to allow goods to move from the first port of entry if it's prohibited goods or in drugs? Why do you want to allow those goods to move all the way inland into Johannesburg, where you can stop the goods already at the first port of entry? Chair, what we've made very clear over and over during this whole process, and we've also, what I should also mention, we can make that available, and hopefully it was made available. We obtained three legal opinions also in this regard, to make sure that there will be no impact as far as the Incoterms or the trade relationships between importers and exporters are concerned. There will be no additional impact on importers. Importers will still, as they used to take responsibility when goods are loaded onto a ship in a foreign harbor, that's when the risk moves from the seller to the purchaser. The same rules will apply in the new environment. It is not our intention to close these terminals. For some reason, misinformation was being fed and kept being fed into the media that SARS wants to close these terminals. We do not want to close them. They are inland terminals in terms of the current legislation, and they will be inland terminals in terms of the new legislation. They will have the same status. There will be no change as far as their status is concerned. The only thing is that we want better information to do a better risk assessment before the goods are allowed to move inland. We're not going to stop every container. We will still only stop 1 or 2%. We will only have better information to target the containers better, to stop the real 1 or 2% that needs to be stopped. We will not congest the ports. That's why we need the information 3 days in advance, and the arrangement with Portnet and Transnet are in place. People can still use rail. That's in sufficient time to plan their value chain for both the sea voyage and the inland voyage, and it will be a seamless voyage up to the end point. We do not want to discourage the use of rail, and as I mentioned, there will be a legitimate goods, there will be no interruption at all. The proposal is being supported here by SARS, as I mentioned. We've also had lots of consultations with the South African Shipping Association. They assured us that they will still be able to issue through bills of lading to have a seamless movement of the goods for both the sea voyage and the voyage, the inland voyage, that it will be a seamless crossover from the one to the other until the last point at the inland terminal in Johannesburg. Transnet also supports the proposal, Chair. Chair, then the second point that came up were around penalties, and mainly around administrative penalties, that the penalties were too high. We had a relook and we did some more international benchmarking, and we reduced these administrative penalties where there will be no revenue impact ultimately. And we also added a provision that if there's been a bona fide error in the process with no revenue prejudice, then there will be no penalties as well. So that deals with the penalties. In the last point from slide 50 onwards, were the issue around the subsidiary legislation, or the rules as we call them in a customs environment. So these bills provide the enabling provisions. Below them will also be customs rules. We have them in the current environment, and we will have them in the new environment. The request during the hearings process was that the rules or the subsidiary legislation should also have been made available now during this process, so that people can see the whole package and not just the enabling provisions. See, that's not how it's normally done. We first finalize the primary legislation or the enabling rules, and then after that, once Parliament has approved the principles that are encapsulated into the primary legislation, then we start with the subsidiary legislation. But what we have done this time, Chair, we have tried to build in many of the procedures that you were found in the rules into the main parts or the main body of the Act as well. So just by way of example, you see that currently the Customs and Excise Act only has 120 sections. If you now look at the two bills, the control bill and the duty bill, it has more than 1,000 sections. Well, yes, granted, I think because we try to follow a more modern style of writing and a simpler way, we have shorter sections. In the old bills you will have long sections, so to some extent that contributed to the more sections. We don't have these long sections that go on for pages and pages, and when you get to page 3 you don't know what you read on page 1 anymore. So we try to use a different style. But on top of that, we have built in more of the procedures in the main body of the legislation now as well. But what we will do, Chair, and the Constitution compels us to do that, that when subsidiary legislation is prepared, then there must be a proper consultation process. So in these bills we also provide for that, that we will publish them for comment. They will ultimately also be available for parliamentary scrutiny. We will workshop these rules when once we publish them. So we will make sure that people have an opportunity to comment extensively as far as that is checked. Chair, thank you very much. I think that then concludes the presentation. I'm sorry I've taken so long, Chair.
You have to apologize. This is very, very important legislation affecting the economy in South Africa. So you don't need to apologize. Thank you for a thorough and comprehensive briefing. From the members, we are all human. I'm going to give you a 5-minute comfort break. Take your cup of tea, whatever, come back to your desk. Let me proceed with the questions and conclude the meeting. The meeting, pardon? Yes, okay, then you will have to meet after 5 o'clock again. Just consult with your whip, please. Just consult with the whip next to you. Thank you, we suspend the proceedings for 5 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Honourable members, can we be seated to go on with our meeting? I note Honorable Mokshishi at the coffee table, but his hand is up. But seeing that he's a senior member in this institution, Honorable Mokshishi, I've noted you. Thank you, Honorable members. Honorable Mashida, please start. I noted Honorable Mashida must attend another meeting at 12.
Yeah. Thank you, Chairperson. I think the very first I'm not sure whether it's a question, but it's definitely a complaint. It looks like there is a confusion. There is a confusion on the role that we have as parliamentarians and the role of the executive. Because it looks like now this one big piece of legislation that we're dealing with, instead of having policies, is actually containing procedures and regulations. It is too far from us than being close to the executive side of formalizing regulations and procedures which are administrative business, and for some reason we are being dragged into actually drafting regulations, and I can see that there are still gaps for them to be really to be taken as regulations and procedures, but almost 80-90% of that is senior, and now it is actually thrown to our heads for us to be asked who are actually taking this. And I really think that it is going to be a problem moving forward, because we're going to start seeing big piece of legislation like this where government is actually throwing everything into us when we are supposed to be really putting policy and approving policies, and they must make the policy to work in terms of procedures, to do interpretation. And I think that is the one comment which I may not really need an answer now, because I don't think there is anyone who will be able to answer that. So then, Chair, on the question of access at the border. Because this piece of legislation are said to really facilitating easy access at our port of entry and for export. I'm just worried about safety and security on its own. Safety and security. Whether that has not been relaxed seriously. Because we know that many things are just getting through our border post, and that's why now we've got even traffic news that are crying in Mozambique, because now it is a lot more easier just to get to Mozambique, to South Africa, getting to Zimbabwe, then have a lot of cigarettes that they just go through the machine and that. And I really just wanted to really question ourselves that why we are trying to facilitate easy access of goods through our port of entry, but safety and security for our own state also must be elevated. And then Chair, on page 7, is the slide 7, on the benchmarking. And then it is referred to Australia, Canada, New Zealand, India, EU, and United Kingdom. Of course, one will appreciate the inclusion of India. But because we are now putting ourselves in the club of the BRICS, why are we not becoming biased to playing the games with the BRICS country, rather than sticking with the West, which we're trying to move away from? And if there is any good explanation on that one, and whether the cabinet really approved this particular bill, knowing that that is what is happening, I just wanted to get some clarity. The Chair, then the question of promoting export by allowing a person to submit an incomplete export declaration for goods container arrived at the container depot without the container number. I really don't know whether this is promoting exports or promoting honor. I'm really not sure. Because surely if this kind of a window is open, anybody, even before they actually get the correct information that you require, they'll just even throw the papers into you. So it's I'm really not sure, and then but it is being mentioned as promoting export, and but I'm seeing it being promoting anarchy. That even when the information is can be sought and be found in time, people may just be throwing that incomplete documentation and say it is your business, then we'll deal with it later. And then the other issue is, Chair, in relation to incorporating SMMEs, then where we are, I think it's on chapter 8, chapters 18 and 19, that provides for the exemption from licensing of premises where subcontracted processing is done below certain thresholds. Then are we also not creating safe haven for illegal activities? Then, Chair, then it looks like this custom duty deal, it is almost based on self-administration. It's like the SARS officials don't actually want to do anything. They want the business to almost run itself. They put the service themselves, the business, whatever they assess into the testing that they want to do. Now the question is, when will SARS officials do the necessary spot check? Spot check. Because, I mean, if you say, no, this service provider, then they can just declare to you what tariffs they are using and then the amount that they need to pay and whatever. And then the customs will just focus on verification of trade, say that self-assessment. But are we going to do specific, at specific intervals, spot checks on those tariffs, the value, the origins, or the assessment itself to verify that these guys are playing the game according to your rules? When is that going to happen? Is there anywhere where you specify that when those particular spot checks will be done? And then now the other thing, Chair, is that when we allow these, the service providers to do this assessment themselves, the evaluation, is SARS planning to educate these people annually on the theories and what they need to consider when they do the evaluation? Because they actually want traders expectation is that we must make sure that these people are using the same rules of the game, the same strategy, they've got the same understanding of classifying these groups. Now, what role is that going to play in educating them, whether on an annual basis or a biannual basis, to make sure that they use the same tools of evaluation, same tools of classification and the rest. Chairperson, when SARS, or let me just simply say on slide number 16, where SARS talks about the refund without application, there is somewhere where they say if a service provider submits a claim, then without supporting documents, then they will apply the penalty to that. I think I've seen that. Yes. Now, this also brings me back to the previous issue that I've raised. Are you going to change this group to know exactly what they're supposed to do? And at what interval will this training happen? Because the question is that when you do this to a small enterprise, and then you apply a panel, you may be close to that little small enterprise now. The same thing goes with that one of seizure and confiscating, blah, 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 your own suspicions. And then the question is that if you realize that no, what you suspected is not correct, and you kept the group for maybe 2 weeks, and you realize that it is not correct what you suspected, then the penalty that SARS is going to pay to this specific individual will be able to cover this extraordinary loss that the service provider may do. As a small enterprise, if the shop ran out of goods because you are keeping them as suspected, only after 2 weeks you realize that no, there is nothing untoward, and the shop has been staying there without goods, what sort of penalty are you going to pay? And is that paid penalty commensurate with the loss that service provider would have incurred? I think I may be getting closer to this one. Slide number 20. The fixed penalty. And then I think that is the one that I was talking to. I actually also just wanted to ask you, when you want to, you want to penalize a person submitting a refund claim without supporting documents, and you penalize the person, what is the intention of this particular approach? Are you intending to intimidate them not to submit a claim when they think that something is due to them? Or what is the intention? Because to me, I don't think that this provision needs to be in. Now, the question of the one-stop entry that we dealt with in South African Mozambique. Remember that I said that there was some sort of a document that we agreed on, and there were certain principles in it. Is it now included? Is that included in this particular piece of legislation? Are they incorporated here? Are they aligned? And then if not aligned, are we going to see an amendment to that document coming in?
Please.
Mr. Chairman, my questions now are greatly reduced. Thank you to Honourable Mashida. Mr. Chairman, I have a concern about slide 20, fixed amounts, as well as Honourable Mashida. So my comment is valid. But it's slightly different. If a claim is put in and for some reason a particular document is not submitted, is there a penalty for that? In other words, there's no intention. I mean, I don't understand why anyone would submit a claim without the relevant documents anyway, intentionally. It would always be unintentionally, and I don't understand why there's a penalty involved there. On the same page, prosecution avoidance penalties. Now, the best way of avoiding prosecution is to do things legally, but now we're going to penalize you for avoiding prosecution. You need to expand on exactly what you mean there. I think I know what you mean, but it's not prosecution avoidance by doing the right thing. I assume it's prosecution avoidance by trying to hide something that you've done incorrectly. But you can explain that. Then the offences and the penalties that are applied, are they simply applied? I mean, is there, what process is followed to allow people to justify themselves? Or it's just an arbitrary, if some official applies penalties, and that's the end, and you have to go to court if you want to challenge those penalties. I've got a tongue-in-cheek question here. It always fascinates me that we try and restrict counterfeit goods. I'm not sure why. I mean, they come in nice and cheap, and I get myself a pair of Levi jeans for a quarter of the price. I mean, why do we want to stop it? But anyway, I think I know the answer to you. But it always fascinates me how in China, there certainly wouldn't be, if Honorable Mashida's now there, they make the counterfeit goods. So if we were to line ourselves up with China, we would certainly have no problem with counterfeit goods. On slide 30, I'm kind of trying to battle with this the single warehousing concept. If goods are imported free of duty, surely then there's no more control required, but subject to VAT. Now VAT, in any event, is controlled by separate legislation and regulations and controls, as is anything in a warehouse. It's not a rebate store, which we used to have in the industry. I used to work in the tie industry where we'd get rebates and we had to have a separate rebate store. This is something different, and I beg your indulgence just to give a little bit of an explanation there, and I've probably just been thick on that one. When on slide 35, in terms of these licensing provisions now, are there no licensing provisions currently? And if so, what happens to those? Do they just automatically change to the new ones, or does everyone have to apply for new licenses? I don't know whether there are even any licenses. Right. This is one of principle in a sense. Duties are imposed not primarily as a source of revenue. That's my understanding anyway. They're duties. And if you go back to the beginning of your, they're not an excise, they're duties, as you correctly pointed out. So if one is trying to promote economic activity, why does one differentiate on the basis of the size of the business? I mean, you say you're trying to support SMME. Surely it should be to support economic activity, whether it's SMME or anything else. But if it's indeed primarily a revenue source, well then I have to rethink the way I view duty. And you've now made these revised proposals. Are they part of the bill or aren't they part of the bill? I mean, are we actually, if we were to vote for the bill now, voting for all these revisions?
Mr. Joseph.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to the panel to clarify, I've heard that the information is online in advance. I just want to know if the payment is also online in advance. If it's identified, how much source you collect. Then I want to ask on page 20, that fixed percentage penalty and couple it with page 48. But page 48 where there's a reduction of 50%, I think. So I wanted to know what is the impact, income impact on that to SARS. Because on 48 there's an amount from 0 to 2,500. But in the building industry, the developer, the builder will pay 3,000 penalty. But they bought illegally a house of 200,000 rand because they know the penalty, so you know, it totally doesn't make sense that you have a penalty of 3,000 and you legally bought 200,000. So I'm saying the penalty must also be in line with what is the contravention. Chair, I would like to just get clarity on two more. I just wanted to, there was a comment on page 34 about the inactivity of client of 3 years that would be taken out of the system, but I don't see it in the red, so I don't know if it's the current status or it's something new that's coming in. I see red under that in terms of the next paragraph. I just want clarity on that. And then there was a lot talk about from the port inland, but I didn't hear anything of from the port to the airport, which is inland. You know, the inland was about rail and those kind of moving of goods. But if something is at Durban Airport or Cape Town Airport, at the harbour, and it's taken to the airport to go inland to a country, what I didn't hear that part of movement of goods. Yes, and I think the last point is the comment made by the first member was a lot about the technicality. But there are, for example, in my experience, prohibited goods. I know a few years ago, America sent a lot of second-hand clothes to NGOs in South Africa, which was not accepted. And I think there's still issues with that where people want to help South Africa, but our customs rules says you can't accept second-hand clothes. And then when the clothes is at the post office, it costs more. In fact, you don't even take it because it's too expensive to take it. So I don't know if that is sorted out, or that is part of the restricted or prohibited goods as an example. We're struggling with many of those kind of things as well. In the past, I'm not sure if it's rectified by now. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, my question is on page 26. Page 26 on chapter 3. Now, the chapter provides for effective customs control of goods and persons entering. Now the key word here becomes effective control. Now I'm looking at the entry at the Johannesburg Airport, and the manner in which the infrastructure layout is such that from passport control you just see a sign that says exit, and it takes you directly to the door. And while customs control is on the far left, and also with respect to personnel, you don't see any intervention for personnel. You see a host of people following each other,
directly from transport out through the main airport. Now, if at the main airport you have a situation of that nature, what of the other two international airports? Now, I'm asking this question also in conjunction with what my colleague has raised in page 48 about the comment on the fixed amount of penalties. Now, I'm not asking about penalties for non-prosecutable breaches. It's mostly about deliberate avoidance and providing false information. Now, in that instance, where false information has been provided deliberately in order to avoid customs taxes and so on, this 48 becomes unfortunate, as my colleague has hinted, that if you say you are going to reduce penalties by 50% or you are going to standardize penalties, now to us it seems like irrespective of the nature of the offense, you are cutting down the penalty. Now, we just need clarity on this one, because the way it comes out, it seems SARC is becoming much more lax when it has to relate to goods coming from outside the country into the country. My other question, Chair President, is on page 25, it's chapter 36. It's on counterfeit goods. I don't see SARS making very strong recommendations with respect to punitive measures on anybody who deliberately brings counterfeit goods in the Republic. Maybe I've captured it somewhere in the bill here, but you have not expanded on it. I would like to find out if there are any punitive measures that SARS has made available. Because we understand what counterfeit goods do to the economy, because that is income that is not accounted for. Now my last question is on page 38. This is chapter 9. Again, it deals with transgressions. Now, the type of transgressions which take place under this chapter 39, I want to believe as well that this may not necessarily be very serious transgressions. Because if they are serious, you are saying the punishment is a penalty. Once they have confiscated the goods, you'll be able to release the goods on a mere penalty. Now my question is, again, do you look at the severity of the transgressions which has been committed? Or you want to adopt the very same principle on a fixed rate? Because some of those officers in the various entry points may be having a point when they begin to charge heavy penalties. It could be different from case to case. But now SARS says, no, just standardize. Yeah, you know, standardize and give 50% for all those who have broken the law on this particular issue. Thank you.
Yes, you've got a short follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just in terms of the position that Bursa has right now, are they comfortable with the revised proposals, particularly regarding the inland port city?
Mr. Lowe, you and your team can reply.
Chair, I'm going to start. My colleagues will come in here and help me where I have slipped up on some of the questions. On the first set, around the confusion around the policy and procedures, you know, that's always a bit of a conundrum that we have. That on the one hand, people say to us, but you are putting too much legislation in the subordinary legislation or in the rules, and you are actually usurping the powers of Parliament as a commissioner. That's on the one hand that we hear. And on the other hand, when there are arguments to say that, okay, we should perhaps not put too many in the main legislation and leave it in the rules so that you have more flexibility and that you don't burden Parliament as far as subordinate legislation is concerned. I think, Chair, when we try to find a balance between the two, we've had criticism in the past that we have put too much in the rules, and even though it looks and that many of the things that are in this thicker customs control bill are procedures, yes, they to a large extent are procedures, but there's policy also encapsulated in that level of procedures. That's the advice that we got from the law advisors, from the people who assisted us with the drafting of the legislation, that we should put as much of the procedures in the main legislation so that it is passed by Parliament, that there's certainty as far as that is concerned for the traders, there's predictability for them, what the rules of the game are, and that customs can't just willy-nilly may keep on changing these rules as they want to. Because that's sometimes the problem that you experience, that people accuse us of, that we've got too much power as far as the rules are concerned. So we try to find a balance and to put more of it in the primary legislation to give Parliament a more stricter oversight. Although the rules ultimately must also be tabled in Parliament, but they're not always necessarily discussed here in Parliament. We table them on an annual basis, but it basically automatically just goes through the process. So we try to find a balance between the two, Chair. On the access at borders, the issue of safety and security, maybe it came across in my presentation that we perhaps were too biased as far as facilitation is concerned, but I can assure you there is a lot as far as control is concerned. That's why I tried to, during the presentation, always say that there should be a balance between the two. It's not just facilitation and it's not just control. It's a balance between the two. Because there's an obligation on us that we should protect the society from a customs point of view, or play a role, and we can't do it on our own, but play a role together with many of the other agencies that we work with to make sure that prohibited goods like drugs, etc., are not coming into the country, that we protect the economy, that goods are not dumped in South Africa, and it is ultimately to the detriment of our South African economy and traders here. So there's definitely a safety and security part in the bill. I think in the, my colleagues can perhaps check also, but I think in the preamble it is made very clear, Chair, that we try to find a balance between the two. As on the one side that there is the revenue collection, but that this Act also creates a legislative framework which must achieve a balance between effective customs control, secure movement of the goods and the people, and from the Republic, and the facilitation of trade and tourism. Where is that one? But there's definitely one that, it says customs administration plays a critical role within the context of international trade and tourism in ensuring effective controls that secure revenue recovery, facilitation of legitimate trade, and protect the society at large. So even in the preamble, it is very clear that the purpose of this bill is also a protection part, both from a society and from the economic point of view and from the fiscal point of view. On the export side, then the issue of incomplete declarations, whether that's not perhaps open to abuse and people can just throw the documentation away. I think, Chair, that what we're providing for is that it's not crucial information that you can just leave off from your declaration. It is information such as the container number, which does play an important role, and you can't just leave it as a complete declaration. You must file a supplementary declaration, and that documentation must be filed before the goods actually goes into the specific terminal or depot, or before it finally leaves the Republic. So before a final decision is made on the issue, we must have all the information. This is a temporary measure to kickstart the process, and not to that the paperwork should not always just hold you up. Once again, it's one of those things that on the one hand people criticize, you know, the customs control, that there's such a lot of red tape, etc., and it hinders trade and it hinders exports. So where we can, we try and see whether we can facilitate things so that at least from an information point of view that you can kickstart the process, but at the end of the day, we need the information before a final decision is made regarding the export or import. On the SMMEs, the subcontracting part, as mentioned, we try to see how we can make things also easier for SMMEs, and whether there is a gap here now for where there's processing done by small businesses in a subcontracting environment, whether that will open the gate for abuse. We hope not, Chair. The main responsibility will always be with the contractor itself. The contractor who subcontracts to smaller businesses will always remain responsible and liable. So everything is not shifted onto the small business at the end, and if there is a fault or an offense or a default at the end, that's the ending process then, and that there is then a possible revenue loss or whatever the case might be. The subcontractor remains jointly responsible with a small business. But we will watch it and see, Chair, how it goes on both these issues of the complete declarations and small businesses. We will watch these processes as they unfold, and obviously if they work, they work. If we see that there is abuse as far as that is concerned, we will have to see where we need to tighten up ultimately. Self-administration, whether we've given everything over now to the business. Chair, that's the process or the way things are going in the modern world today. And it's not just so as far as customs is concerned. Even as far as our other taxes are concerned, on the VAT legislation, it all works on a self-assessment basis. Income tax today, when you file your income tax return, you make a self-declaration basically in your income tax return. You declare all your income, all your expenses, and you submit it, and today the computer just processes it. We do spot checks and we do audits, yes, but it's impossible in today's environment to assess each and every person and each and every import. And volumes are just, it's just mind-boggling. That's the way the world has gone on a self-assessment basis, and that we then can intervene afterwards. How we do it in different ways. Risk assessment works in on different ways. We do random audits, for example. For example, that every 100 or every 1,000 person or container might be picked for an audit. Then that's the one way. Another way is on a risk basis, where we have risk engines and where information is fed into these risk engines. It's the information that the importer or the exporter supplies himself or herself. It's third-party information that we get. We analyze the trends of the importer and exporter, import patterns, export patterns. All those things are taken into consideration, and ultimately a risk assessment is then done to say that this container needs to be stopped from a risk point of view. Many a time we allow goods to move, but we have post-audit clearance inspections. If it's very high risk goods, we will stop it at the border. That will be a very small percentage. If it's still sort of low to medium risk, we will allow it to move inland, and we inspect it at an inland terminal, or we even inspect it at the importer's premises or whatever the case might be. And then there are some of it that poses no risk, and that is just that just moves seamlessly. On the education side, Chair, that links with the previous question, that if a lot is done by agents or importers, etc., what do we do to make sure that they are educated as far as this is concerned? Well, from our side, and there's a number of things people can do. People can approach us, for example, if they answered. We can give them a ruling as far as a specific issue is concerned. If somebody is unsure about a tariff classification or a value issue or an origin issue, they can approach us and we can give them a ruling. We issue interpretation notes or guides to explain in a specific topic in general or a specific chapter in general or whatever the case might be. We arrange workshops. We have dedicated workshops that go countrywide. They focus specifically on different sectors. When we have workshops specifically for small businesses, if there are new interventions or new pieces of legislation that are coming on board, we have specific workshops as far as that is concerned, and I'm sure when these bills go out, we will have opportunities where we will interact with the public as far as this is concerned. Also, the work as far as imports and exports are to a large extent done by agents that act on behalf of importers and exporters. And these agents are licensed, and they are licensed, and there are certain conditions that comply to them, that they need to have certain training, certain qualifications, etc. So we try to control them from that point of view as well. On penalties, Chair, there were, I think, quite a number of issues. Let me say that the penalty regime is a structured regime. We have structured it in the basis that there are, first of all, fixed type of penalties, and these are for your smaller, mundane type of offences, where we have fixed types of penalties that will be prescribed in terms of specific ranges. So the one example that was mentioned, we have a penalty structure, and there are, I think, four or five bands. And I think we quoted in the slide the first band, which will be from 0 to 2,500. So in the rules we are now going to prescribe in that, for that category of penalties, what are the different kinds of offences, and we will put specific values to them. For instance, offence A will perhaps be 50 rand, offence B 100 rand, offense C will be 200 rand. So it will be specifically prescribed within that range from 0 to 2,500. So it doesn't mean everybody will get a 2,500 penalty. The detail will be given in the rules. What are the offenses sitting within that range between 0 to 2,500? Once you have committed an offense, say that it is now prescribed, and it's offense A, and it's 50 rand, that will be the penalty. The reason why we've gone for such an approach, and that's an international norm that is being followed now, is in your older type of legislation, it was a very open-ended, discretionary type of penalty. You just said that you can give the person a penalty between 0 and 200%. And we found that it was all over the show. There was no consistency by our officers, how they applied, I mean, these penalties, how they exercised their discretion as far as that is concerned. Some would always just give 200%, some just 100%. So the idea is here that we are more prescriptive. We say exactly what is the offense, and then what is the penalty for that. Yes, you must still apply your mind, and the crime must still fit the penalty. So you must still apply your mind whether the offense falls within category A, within the range 0 to 2,500. But once you determine the penalty falls within that category, that will be the penalty. So what it helps to, it helps that there is more consistency and uniformity as far as the application of the penalty regime is concerned. That is not at the willy-nilly discretion of an officer. So they are guided on how they must make their decisions for different kinds of offenses. Then there was a question, I think, on the intention of penalties. Yes, I think for your more serious types of offenses, when intention may always then plays a role, and it would specifically be prescribed what the exact offense is that you've committed, and as I've explained, what the penalty is that will be linked to that. But normally with offenses, and more serious type of offenses, there's always an intentional element as far as that is concerned. But hopefully we will get it right, and we will work on a proportional basis that the penalty must fit the ultimate crime. There was a last question, I think, by that gentleman on whether we have, on the one-stop border post, whether we've built that into this legislation now. That is not built into this legislation. That process started in terms of the old legislation, and it was given effect to in terms of an international agreement between South Africa and Mozambique. The agreement is an international agreement, and it has now been ratified by both houses of parliament. So that process will still be concluded in terms of the old legislation. Yes, the new legislation also has provisions and allow us to enter into international agreements for one-stop border posts. Then there were another set of questions. First one was also around penalties and the amounts of penalties and prosecution avoidance penalties. As far as prosecution avoidance penalties are concerned, first of all, the penalties that we are talking about here are penalties for offenses. So once you've committed an offense, it's actually a crime that you've committed. And normally with offenses, you should process it into the criminal courts. And you can either get a jail sentence or you'll get a monetary penalty as far as that is concerned. But it is impossible for us to process all these offenses through the criminal justice system. And that you will find, as far as many departments are concerned, that you then have a set of administrative penalties as well. Yes, we will always have the option to charge somebody criminally as well. So it will depend on how serious the offense is, what are the volumes, what's the capacity of the criminal justice system, etc. Some of them we will definitely refer to the NPA for processing through the criminal justice system, but some we will try and resolve on an administrative basis, and therefore we have the concept of a prosecution avoidance penalty. So you pay an administrative penalty, and then we don't prosecute you criminally. The process around penalties, yes, a person will have an opportunity in the process before we raise the penalty. You will have the opportunity to state your case, and we will have the look at the facts, and then we will apply our mind, and then ultimately a penalty will be imposed. Counterfeit goods. On counterfeit goods, I think it is important that a country should have many rules around many counterfeit goods. The main rules, I must just say, around counterfeit goods are not really in the customs and excise. There's a separate act that the DTI administers, which is actually the Counterfeit Goods Act, which actually spells out the main principles around counterfeit goods. We are just assisting in the process as far as counterfeit goods are concerned, to assist the DTI to detect counterfeit goods. So what will happen if a brand holder or a license holder or a right holder as far as certain intellectual property is concerned think that there is first of all it's a personal right. They can then lodge an application for SARS if they think that there are certain goods that are counterfeit goods. We can then the Customs Act and the new rules will kick in. We can then investigate, and if we think that there is a possibility of counterfeit goods, we can detain these goods, but then it's ultimately for the right holder to, in terms of the Counterfeit Goods Act, to take the matter to court, and then the court will decide whether this is Counterfeit Goods Act or not, counterfeit goods or not. We are just assisting in the administration of it and detection of it and detaining it, etc. But I think it's important for a country because it protects your economy, it protects your traders, it protects your right holders, etc.
Okay. Okay.
I think it's
important. Let's off the record, please proceed, Mr. Lowe.
Good. slide 30, let me just free of duty. This is the mixture of the goods in the same warehouse. As I explained, duty only becomes payable once good goes into free circulation, when it's for home consumption. So when goods go into a warehouse, it's still in a duty-free status. So we always have the situation that you can the goods can go into the warehouse and have a duty-free status, but vegetable goods couldn't go in there and be stored in the same warehouse. So now we extend it to that as well, and we extend it to goods that are in free circulation. So I think it makes it much easier for traders and exports to manage their warehouses much better.
Mr. Jim, my apologies. Yeah, my concept of duty-free is that something there's no duty payable on. This is something that there is duty payable on, but not yet paid.
Not yet.
So I apologize, but I didn't...
Good.
You explained it. Carry on.
Okay, on the licensing, whether when the new licensing provisions kicks in, what will be the effect? There are transitional provisions in the law to deal with that. But ultimately, all license holders will have to reapply for their licenses. But your old license will stay in place until your new license has been processed. So there will not be an immediate disruption or just stoppage of your old license. On duties, and the purpose of duties and SMMEs, how they support the economy. I think I mean, the imposition of duties, I mean, there's a dual purpose, I think, for it. I mean, yes, I mean, customs duty, I mean, it was a revenue, it's a revenue-raising measure as well. In the old days, I think customs duties were actually many countries' main source of income. You still find it in Africa. I think many African countries, customs duties are still their main source of income. It exceeds by far their income taxes and their VAT, etc. So on the one hand, it's definitely a revenue-raising instrument. It plays a lesser role today in South Africa. If you've been customs duties, we only collect nowadays about 40 billion out of almost 900 billion. I mean, that's our total revenue target for this year. So you can see it's a very small proportion, but it's still a revenue-raising measure. The revised proposals, whether they're in the main bills, no, they're not in these main bills, they're in the A bills. In the A bill that was put before in the committees. So once both committees and houses adopt the bills together with the A bills, then they will emerge and there will be a consolidated bill that will then have incorporated all the revisions as well. The next set of questions on, I mean, there's a lot of on reporting that is now advanced reporting. Must the duties also now be paid in advance? No, the duties are not paid in advance. The duties, as I said, custom duty is a consumption tax. It only, the payment only happens when the goods go into home use. So the goods must first arrive in South Africa, and it's only when it goes into free circulation that the actual payment of the duties occur. Liability can arise at an earlier stage, but actual payment only kicks in when it goes into home consumption. Penalties, I hope I've explained the penalty structure and the ranges and what sits within the ranges, etc. They will not all be 2,500, as I explained. There will be categories within the ranges and so on. Then there was a question about slide 34, after 3 years. I think that was at the registration. Oh, sorry. Oh, the inactivity of the client. No, it's something new. Sorry, you're absolutely right. It should have been in red. That was a slip up from our side. Then there were questions around from the inland port to the container inland terminals. Maybe if I could just run through it again. This is in respect of containerized goods. Currently those goods, sales goods that are coming from China, and they're in containers and they're destined for ultimate for a trader who sits in Johannesburg, but they're importing it via Durban. So what can happen today, the goods, when they land at the Durban harbour, the goods can move on the basis of a manifest. And a manifest is not a customs clearance document. It's a document that are issued by the shipping lines. It has very scant and little information, and it moves on the basis of that document from Durban to an inland terminal in Johannesburg. That's a concern for us, because we don't know much about the goods that are inside that container. There can be all sorts of funny goods and prohibited goods or risky goods in that container. The shipping document tells us very little of what is inside that container. We want to change that regime, that there is a clearance document that must be given to us, not just the manifest. The manifest they will still give to us, but there's a customs clearance document that they must give to us, which will contain much better information. And the information will now be supplied to us by a South African, which we can hold responsible if we find out that false information was given to us eventually. And the information will tell us exactly what the goods are, what the value of the goods are, where the goods are coming from, etc. So that we can do a proper risk assessment, whether we can allow the goods to move from the first port of entry inland. If it's very high risky goods, we will not allow it to move to the inland terminal. The container will first be inspected at the first port of entry. If we do find that there are prohibited goods there, we will detain the goods and confiscate it if it's drugs or whatever the case might be. If the risk engine does not throw it out as high risk goods, we will allow it to move seamlessly to the inland port. It will ultimately be only a very small proportion of goods that we will stop at the first port of entry, and we will not clog up the ports or interrupt the proper movement of goods. Yeah, and it does not apply to airports. This only applies to goods that are come via a ship. Sorry. Second-hand clothing. Yes, I think the rules of the game have now been sorted out. There's a certain discretion that has been signed off by the DG of DTI and National Treasury under what circumstances second-hand clothes can be allowed into South Africa. But once again, the reason why it is strictly controlled, it is once again for the protection of the local industry. You can't also just allow goods and second-hand goods to be swamped into South Africa, because ultimately it impacts on your South African traders and your textile industry in South Africa. We've seen what happened to the textile industry in South Africa. So even if it's for a good cause, ultimately it needs to be controlled. Effective customs control. I think you mentioned that what happens at the main airport, etc. And it looks as if everybody just walks through and declares nothing. I think to some extent, Chair, that's an international phenomenon that you have what they call a sort of a green channel and a red channel. If you don't think you've got anything to declare, you walk through the green channel and you just then go through. If you have anything to declare, then you go to customs and you declare your goods there. What you perhaps don't know is what is happening also behind the scenes. And that's why I try to stress throughout the presentation that information is such an important tool for the customs authority. And that we need that information long before people or goods arrive in South Africa. So long before the plane has landed in South Africa, the customs people behind the scenes will know exactly who are all the people who were on the plane. They would have analyzed some of the patterns of those people on the plane, how regularly have all the people, and the computer can kick out in a second for you whether Mr. A on a specific plane has traveled the last year 10 times between Sao Paulo or South Africa, or what whatever the case might be. And it kicks out certain patterns, it analyzes certain information, for example, that's stored on the system. We share information with Home Affairs, with DTI, etc. So the risk engine might kick out what the normal person might not see and identify two or three people on a plane that even though they don't come forward themselves, but in some way they are, stopped and their baggage men are being investigated. Penalties, I think we've covered the types of penalties. Then fixed amount penalties are for your smaller, low level type of infringements. The prosecution avoidance penalties are not, I think, a measure that shows that hopefully that we are becoming lax. And the reduction of the penalties that we are proposing in this bill is only in respect of the fixed amount penalties, which is the low level ones. The reduction of the penalties that we are proposing is not for the prosecution of ordnance penalties. They will stay as originally proposed in terms of the book. I think the counterfeit goods I've hopefully dealt with. Chapter 39, yes, I think it's also in the context of the penalties. Yes, we look at the severity of the penalties, that we hopefully will ultimately levy a penalty that will fit the crime and that's proportional then to what the crime is. And it's, to some extent, although it's a standardized approach, but it is within certain categories that the customs officer then must then ultimately make the call to say that if this is the offense, it falls within that category and within that range, but there's a specific penalty attached to it, and as I try to explain it, to standardize it and to get a more uniform application of the penalty system, that people don't get the impression that because somebody just look at your face and you think, this is a nice guy, I'm going to only give him 5% and that one 200%, and at the end it's all over the shelf. It's to standardize to get uniformity as far as the penalty structure is concerned. On the Buza issue, Chair, I don't think Buza is comfortable today. But on the main proposal, they are not happy, I think. JCCI are not happy with our main proposal. SAF is happy with our proposal. Transnet is happy with our proposal. And I think the shipping lines also think it can work. But on the main proposal, Buza and the JCCI, they are not happy. They are, however, I think, happy that we've included the type of a fallback position, so that in case ultimately we see that there's a problem, that we can deviate from the main rule, but I don't think they're happy with the main rule. I hope I've dealt with most of the questions.
On Mr. Lowe, I think you extensively replied to the questions. Are there any quick follow-ups? Because there's other engagements between one and two of them, please.
Chairman, just a quick explanation of the risk that is perceived to exist by allowing the goods to move to the inland port. Because, as I understand it, they would still go through the same process at the inland port as they would at the seaport. So what is the risk that you talk about?
Chief, the risk is that we may allow prohibited goods and restricted goods and other types of goods that we need to control to move inland, which should not be moved inland. It's difficult, although we have many, many examples, and in City Deep, for example, we find that the audits that we do there, as far as low value inspections are concerned, or prohibited goods that we find there, on average the inspections show that there is a 20% higher discrepancy rate at City Deep compared to the average of 14% in the rest of the country. So at City Deep we find that there's a double the normal percentage of transgressions when we inspect containers. That's what we find on the ground. That's number one. Number two, I don't think we even know about all of it, because the big problem is there's been a huge movement from rail transport to road transport. We don't know if a truck leaves Durban and by the time it arrives in Johannesburg, what has been diverted along the road. What if that container or that truck has been opened, what has been taken out? So by the time it reaches City Deep, we can inspect the container 100 times, we'll find nothing in there. So the one thing is we don't know what we don't know. So we need better information to do a proper risk assessment. at the first port of entry, to have a better control, a better risk analysis, and to stop those containers and not allow those prohibited goods. Why do we want to allow drugs to move all the way inland only to detect it inland, or other harmful type of goods, or from an agricultural point of view, plants or seeds or insects or whatever the case might be that can spread and chemicals or whatever the case might be. It's an international norm now. The world is moving in that direction. Their goods are now inspected. They want proper information that a proper risk analysis can be done at the first port of entry. We have just recently, and the notion is that if goods move by train, there's a lesser possibility, and that it's safer that if goods are packed on, containers are packed on the train, there's a lesser chance that, goods can be fiddled with on the train, and goods can be siphoned off or diverted when along the road. We've just stopped, recently, a train with 400 containers with suspected counterfeit goods on. We're still in the process of analyzing it all. But there were 400 containers with counterfeit goods. I think the trade unions made a very impressive presentation also at the hearings in the Standing in Committee on Finance. And they've done an analysis of the goods that are being imported from China alone. And in terms of their analysis that they've done, just on China, the imports from China alone, they have found, in terms of their analysis, that there was an under-declaration of 7 billion in respect of textile imported from China. That's their value, that's not the excise duty on its own. I can give you many examples, and we've taken the previous committee through it, and we thought about putting it in here, but the presentation will get so long in the end, of examples that we have found in the textile industry, how goods have been misclassified. Textile goods have been classified as toys, where there's a zero rating as far as those goods are concerned. These are not just, at the end of the day, issues where it's a duty that you avoid and there's an impact on the fiscus as well. There's a broader impact on the country and on the economy. If these goods are coming in, people don't pay any duties on it, they've got a competitive advantage in comparison to compliant traders who pay their duties. So you have a competitive advantage above any other traders in the market. Here I can go on and give you lots of other examples why it is important, I think, that we should have this.
Those members coming back after elections can carry on with the session when they come back. Let me just show you. Annelies, will you hand up?
Mr. Chairman, Chris, you've given a lot of reasons for more control over goods coming into the country, but very little about why they shouldn't be checked in Johannesburg as opposed to Durban. The seeds are in Durban. They can contaminate us there as easily as they can in Johannesburg. And those kind of issues, I don't think are I wouldn't consider them to be reasons for stopping the process. The intervention on routes might well be a good reason, but I'm not sure that the problem is as big as it to justify that. I haven't 400 containers on one train. I don't know. I would need more comfort about the real problem. So I'm sorry. I don't accept that there isn't. The process needs to be slowed down, because that's the fear. You're assuring us that if there is a slowdown, there's a fallback position. That the goods should not go through exactly the same process. We're not suggesting that they should be go travel on a manifest and simply be offloaded and then go on that basis. They go through the same process. So, I hear all the arguments textiles and all the rest, but those will be picked up either in Johannesburg or in Durban or wherever the other port of entry.
Honourable members, thank you. Honourable members, I'm going to put to you, we've done this now extensively, I believe. If we received these bills far in advance, we could have done an oversight to these inland ports, what they call them, but we can't do it anymore. I'm putting to the committee the customs duty bill, clauses 1 to 229. Because there's three bills, but actually we're dealing with it in a package, but we will do the report individually. I put to the committee the customs duty bill, clauses 1 to 229. Can I get a mover that we adopt the bill?
Chairman, sorry, I am on the point of order. We would like to put amendments, and you haven't allowed us that opportunity. And secondly, we need clarity on what bills we're going to vote on, because I don't have the A bill.
We vote on all of them. The customs duty bill is a section 77 bill.
Chairman, this is not the A bill that of course was referring to.
Mr. Lowe.
Chair, there should be ultimately the three main bills, that's the customs duty bill, the customs control bill, and the customs and excise bill. And then there's the A bills, the A bill for the customs control bill and the A bill for the customs and excise amendment. So there's five in total.
Can you please explain?
Chairperson, what the bills that have been referred to the committee is Bill 43, Bill 44B, and Bill 45B. So the Bill 44B and 45B are the bills as amended by the Standing Committee. Those are the bills that are referred to the committee. The A bill is already worked into this B bill document. So the committee has only been referred the B bill to consider as amended by the Standing Committee. So it's not the A bill isn't before, the A list of amendments isn't before the committee. The bill is as amended.
Advocate Jenkins?
No, Chair, I'm covered. I just wanted to say that A bill is the A list, so to speak, is included in the B version of it.
Thank you. Then I put again the customs duty bill to the committee, sections 1 to 229. Honorable
Nguni. Move like this, sir.
Moves to adoption. Any seconder? Seconded. Honorable Faku.
I second, Honorable.
Thank you. Thank you.
We support that bill, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. So, I just want for record purposes that the Select Committee on Finance, having considered the customs duty bill, D43-2013, National Assembly, Section 77, as referred to it and classified by the JTM as a Section 77 bill, reports that it has agreed to the bill. Thank you, all the members that covered that one. Then the customs control bill, it's clauses 1 to 944, the thick one. I put the customs control bill to the committee. Honourable Chani?
I move to
adoption.
Adopt.
Bill Monsisi supports.
On a point of order, we have to have the opportunity to move amendments. We can't put the bill.
I recognize your hand. I'm giving you now the opportunity.
After it's been put, Mr. Chairman. Okay, that's great. Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, we move that the sections that include the concept of an inland port be retained.
And you please assist in the secretariat that what you are tabling, that you just read in writing for them, that it's captured correctly into the minutes. That will assist us a lot. But you can read it out. to go on record.
I've made the amendments, the proposed amendments.
Thank you, then, all of them. To which clause do you propose?
Chairman, all clauses that refer to the Inland Port, and that will be up to the researcher to establish that.
Okay, you will then table it. I've written the report to the committee, the Select Committee on Finance, having considered the Customs Control Bill, the 45B of 2013, National Assembly, Section 75, has referred to it and classified by the JTM as the Section 75 bill, report that it has agreed to the bill. And you will then make your declaration in the House.
Yeah, and we record out the DA's objection.
Okay. Thank you. The third one. Honourable members, the last one is the Customs and Excise Amendment Bill, B44B 2013, clauses 1 to 88. I put this to the committee.
I move.
Monsisi moves for adoption. Seconder. Honourable Fox.
Seconds.
Are there any other inputs?
Chairman, we again, in terms of this bill, wish to retain the section allowing for carriers to deliver containers to inland port and upon.
As previous, that you will submit your input. Thank you. The Select Committee on Finance, having considered the Customs and Excise Amendment Bill, B44B 2013, National Assembly Section 75, as referred to it and classified by the JTM as a Section 75 Bill, reports that it has agreed to the bill. Thank you, honourable members. Thank you to Mr. Lowe and his team. It was a lengthy meeting. Honourable members, tomorrow morning, Select Committee on Appropriations, Friday briefings in the provinces on the Division of Revenue and the Financial Management of Parliament Amendment Bill. Next week, the negotiating mandates, etc. And then we head for 26th of March. So there's still a lot of work on the journey. I think you might just, if I left it, something out.
No, Chair, I just a notice that honourable members will get messages with regards to tomorrow evening dinner for the joint session with the National Assembly at one of the places in Waterfront, but the details thereof will be circulated to honourable members later today. Thank you.
Thank you, honourable members. That is something to look forward. We can relax without bills on the table. Thank you. The meeting stands adjourned. Thank you.